From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. And this morning, Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with Live Like Sam co-founder Skylar Jackenthal, who talks about her new podcast called Good Grief, Life After Loss. It is part of our new monthly segment, the first segment, called Resilient Youth. We've partnered with Live Like Sam to explore all the forces that shape and influence our young people to become healthy, happy, and to thrive. So we will air a segment the last Wednesday of every month at 9 a.m. And we're really excited to be speaking with Skylar Jackenthal this morning. And in the second half, Dr. Ailey Cohen. She is a board-certified rheumatologist and integrative medicine physician. She joined to talk all about detoxification. It's her new book, Detoxify, the Everyday Toxins Harming Your Immune System. That's all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. This morning, in recognition of May Mental Health Month and our new monthly segment called Resilient Youth, we speak with the co-founder of Live Like Sam, Skylar Jackenthal. Skylar is also a new podcaster. Her podcast is called Good Grief, Life After Loss.
Skylar co-founded Live Like Sam along with her dad, Ron, following the untimely death of Sam Jackenthal, her brother, in a skiing accident in Australia in 2015. Skylar was 14 years old then, and since then, she has been learning how to navigate grief, how to thrive, not just survive. And she joins us today to talk about grief, about how young people are doing with grief and all kinds of other challenges. She'll talk also about her new podcast. Skylar, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I listened to both episodes. You just dropped your second episode of Good Grief. It's so interesting because even as a parent, I hear what you're saying and I realize that so many young people experience grief, not the extreme type of grief that you did when you lost your brother Sam, now almost 10 years ago, but a lot of young people experience a ton of grief in all different kinds of ways. Have you found the same?
Yes, definitely. I found that even when talking to friends or complete strangers, everyone has experienced some form of grief, whether that's, you know, injury and losing the sport they love, which is very familiar to a lot of athletes in Park City, or losing a friend or your parents getting divorced or whatever it is, even loss of self-identity. I feel like everyone who I've spoken to about this podcast, even if they haven't directly lost a person in their life, can relate to the feelings of grief that I also have.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, going back 10 years to the grief that you felt then? You do a really great job of talking about how it was for you in this community where everyone knew Sam, everyone knew what happened. And then going away from the community when you went to college, the different ways of interacting with people.
Yeah, I talk about it in my second episode, but I just did not realize how fortunate I was, I'd say, to have the close, tight-knit community of Park City. When Sam passed away, the community really rallied around our whole family and there was support in every corner. But with that came the fact that truly at the time, everyone in the community knew who Sam was. They knew who our family was. It was great because we felt all that support. But I also never had to talk to anyone really and tell them about, like, oh, my name's Skylar. I lost my brother, Sam. I'm now an only child. Like, people already knew that about me. It was very, I had that very defined persona in the community. And when I left about 4 years after Sam passed away to go to college in Boston was the first time that I truly experienced like leaving the Park City community and having to kind of share that news of my loss and my grief with new people. And it was very jarring to realize that for the past 4 years, I had been shielded by the Park City bubble, and I didn't even realize it until the time came to meet new people and introduce myself as a brand new person for the first time.
Yeah, I listened to your second episode. It was great. Thank you. And
I thought that that was a really terrific distinction that you made about how difficult it is to know how much to say about some of these pivotal situations that have shaped who we are. And my mom has always said, you know, there's a word for someone who's lost a spouse. You know, they're a widow or a widower. If you've lost your parents, you're an orphan, but there isn't a word for a mother or father who's lost a child or a sibling who's lost another sibling. And those definitions are important, you know. Maybe share a little bit with our listeners about what you talked about in the podcast, about how that awkwardness of knowing how much to reveal when you meet a new person.
Yeah, I think when you ask someone, oh, do you have any siblings, or what does your mom do for work? Are you close with your dad? You expect a very generic answer there. Oh, I have a brother and a sister. My mom works at the hospital, and yeah, my dad and I are close. Like, you expect that. You don't expect to open the floodgates for someone's traumatic backstory, which I think is fair that when asking that, you expect, just as when you ask someone how they are, they just say good, and that's the end of the conversation. You don't dive into how you truly are. And that's definitely something I have struggled with over the years. I've yet to find what is the perfect answer when someone asks me if I have any siblings. I talked about it in the podcast, but maybe the world would see me as an only child now, but I certainly did not grow up that way. And I don't see myself as an only child. So much of who I am and my personality was shaped by the fact that I grew up with a big brother. But there really is no right way to answer the question, do you have any siblings, when the answer is so complicated. And I get that question frequently just a few minutes into meeting someone for the very first time. So it's especially hard to know, like, is this conversation going to end in 5 minutes and I'll never see you again? Or are you going to become a best friend and you're going to be in my life forever and I should choose my words carefully here? It's a very interesting game to play.
Yeah, and that's got to be really difficult in the moment, trying to evaluate the future prevalence of this person in your life. Like, if you just are meeting them, wow, yeah, that creates an even yet another hamster wheel in your brain, trying to figure out how to appropriately manage that. Does somebody deserve to know the whole story? Have they earned the right to kind of open that window into your life? I lost my sister in the late fall this year. It was a fascinating thing. I come from a big family, and seeing the different ways that everybody processed their grief. And some people are very demonstrative. Some people are very internal. Do you find people talk to you about their grief in different ways?
Yes, definitely. First off, I'm sorry for your loss. But it is true that everyone handles grief in such different ways. It's very unpredictable. Even in my own family, my parents both handle it in a very different way. And I almost find that I change the way I approach the subject and celebrate Sam's anniversaries, depending on, you know, which parent I'm interacting with. Even just within the past few weeks since releasing this podcast, I've received just an outpouring of messages, which has been so appreciated. But even in those messages, I can see some people handle grief in such different ways. Some people are messaging me and the emotions are still very raw and real, and they're still in that, in the sadness and the anger and the denial. Other people are at acceptance and just sharing the, you know, that they appreciate what I'm doing and they wish the message had been there. But I think even now, it's been almost 10 years, and even I still don't know how to approach the subject of other people's grief. There is a very short list of right and wrong, of the right things to say, the right way to respond, and a very long, long list of the wrong things to say when someone shares their grief with you. And even as someone myself who lost my brother 10 years later, I still struggle with knowing the right way to respond to people sharing their stories. But I have definitely noticed that there's just such a wide range of how people approach grief. Some people, like my dad and I, are so open with it. It's almost become a script to share Sam's story with the world because we do it over and over and over again every day with Live Like Sam and sharing his memory. And with other people, it's just a special part of themselves that they like to keep a secret, and you maybe will never hear about their grief until you've become very close with them. And I think there's no right way to do it. I think both sides of the spectrum are totally valid.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Skylar Jackenthal. She is the co-founder of Live Like Sam. She's Sam Jackenthal's sister, and she is also a new podcaster. Her podcast is called Good Grief, Life After Loss. Skylar, one of the things you talk about is how even though you knew that everyone in the Park City and the greater Park City community knew about your loss, the way that the people approached you or talked to you about it was always so different. And as you say, there's a short list of the right things to say and a long list of the wrong things to say. But what were the various ways in how people, and especially other young people, approached you?
Yeah, one of the most memorable moments when I first returned to school after losing Sam, which was just absolutely terrifying, knowing that I was walking into this place where everyone's already judgmental and just young and already doesn't know the right things to say, walking in. And one of the very first things someone said to me is a kid came up to me and said, like, Skylar, I heard about your brother. Is it true he died in a shark attack in Australia? And I don't even know how or where that one came from, but that was just like the first of so many examples. I was greeted by a lot of people doing the right thing, just coming up to me and saying, you know, like, I just want you to know I'm here for you. I support you, whatever you need. And that was honestly the best thing, just to know like someone's acknowledging what happened, but they're not really inserting themselves into the situation. They're just kind of loving from afar and loving from a distance. I also really struggled with the social media aspect. I would share, you know, a picture of Sam on social media, and my comment section was just flooded with people posting blue hearts and sending, you know, loving comments. But I definitely struggled with the fact that on social media, I was feeling all that love and attention. And then in person in school, the same person who had just commented, I'm here for you, blue heart, like, we wouldn't even talk to me in school, or we weren't even friends on that level. And it's a very confusing thing, especially as a young person, to know, like, how do I show support for someone during this time?
It's got to be so hard. As you say, young people don't know what they want to say for just regular things, let alone something so traumatic like that. I remember my son was in fourth grade and his best friend's dog died in a really sudden and horrible way. And I kept saying, you just need to say something. You can't, you know, he just wanted to act like nothing happened. Mm-hmm. And then his bottom line was, I don't want to remind him about it by saying anything. And my comment to that was, do you think he's really forgetting about it? I don't
Yes.
think so.
Yeah. That is something even recently I've really been trying to project that message to others in my life. Even, for example, like, it was just Mother's Day. I unfortunately have a lot of young people in my life who have lost a mother way too soon. And there is that question of, I want to send them a message that I want them to know I'm thinking about them. And I've heard it over and over from people, like, but I don't want to remind them. What if they weren't thinking about it? And the reality is, it's Mother's Day. If you don't have a mother, you are thinking about her no matter what. There's no way you're forgetting that. And it's same with birthdays and anniversaries of a loved one. Like, these days don't go by unnoticed. And I think it's valid to have that fear of not wanting to remind them of their loss, but I can almost 100% guarantee they are always thinking of that person.
I think it's a courageous gesture to reach out to people in those cases, because just saying, I'm thinking of you today, you know, it means a lot. Well, let's talk a little bit about the origins of your Good Grief podcast, this new venture. What's already out there for siblings? Is there much, or what created the awareness that this was something that might be needed?
I have found that there's very minimal resources out there, not just for sibling loss, but just for young people in general. Everything feels very clinical. It's, you know, written by psychologists. It's all kind of information and advice given by older people who potentially have never even been in that situation of losing someone as a young person, or have never lost anyone at all. And so I very quickly realized there was a lack of resources. I share on the podcast, I immediately turned to Reddit of just like, how do I go back to school after my brother just died? There's no answer for that on the internet. What do I say when people say the wrong thing? How do I respond if someone asks if I have a sibling and my brother is dead? Like, I was Googling the most absurd questions and, of course, finding no answer because there just isn't, it isn't talked about enough, unfortunately. And it became very clear to me very quickly after Sam passed away, once I joined the grief group at the high school, which was really my turning point in my grief journey. I immediately became exposed to the fact that there were so many other young people in the Park City community who had also lost a sibling, a parent, all at a young age. And unfortunately, I really do believe that Park City over-indexes in young people passing away too soon. I've just been exposed to it so many times. And as I've left Park City, I realized that's not the case in other communities. So it quickly became clear that there were a lot of people in my shoes looking for resources, looking for answers, and finding a dead end, which is why I decided to create this podcast to hopefully kind of form a virtual grief group where any young person anywhere struggling with grief can tune in, hear my own personal stories and experiences, and also hear from other young people coming to share their experiences of loss, but also how they found a way to live a happy, healthy life after experiencing such tragic loss at a young age.
One of the things that I really appreciated when I listened to your inaugural and second episode was the casualness of the language, the way that this is for young people. You're talking about, like, do I disclose to some rando? And I was just dying laughing because I was like, you speak like a young person. And yeah, that's really refreshing after, like you said, there's a lot of clinical, a lot of professional level stuff. Sometimes you just want to feel seen and feel heard. What kind of topics do you hope to cover in the near future that might be of a special interest to teens? And
yeah, definitely my goal is to keep, I mean, obviously we're going to cover sad topics, we have to, but my goal really is to keep it casual, keep it relatable. I think as someone who hasn't experienced grief, it's hard to accept or recognize that sometimes grief is funny and awkward and uncomfortable, and just like, you only can understand the humor in these situations once you've been in them. From the outside, maybe it's mortifying. From the inside, some things you're like, this is just hilarious that I am in this situation having this conversation with this person. So I want to make all the content very relatable. Plan on talking about, like I already did, how to share the news with someone new, how to celebrate the anniversaries and birthdays of a loved one, definitely highlighting other voices, really just sharing any and all of the relatable and just not talked about areas of grief, especially for young people.
Skylar, I'm curious about how the going into this project of the podcast has transformed the process of healing and how it has differed from when you and your dad almost immediately started Live Like Sam. I've often wondered about the healing process for your family as a result of this incredible foundation. But the two things are very different. One is about helping other kids and honoring Sam's legacy. And this one, does it feel more personal to you?
Yeah, one thing that I really have wanted to focus on when starting this podcast is that Live Like Sam, I fully want that to be, that is Sam's legacy 100%. He has such a powerful legacy. I want it to be able to touch everyone in the community, but he is gone and I'm still here. And that's why I want this podcast to be 100% my legacy. Of course, I'm talking about Sam in every episode and sharing the stories of losing him, but I really want this to be focused on my story, youth grief, and just helping other young people through the hardest time in their life. Live Like Sam is obviously a much broader area of focus. We're really looking to make a difference in the life of every single young person in the Park City community. Thankfully, this podcast is not going to resonate with all of them, and I'm very happy that that's the case. But I think those who this podcast does resonate with really are going to have a need for this content, and I really hope they can connect with it.
You know, you talked about the turning point being this grief group at the high school, Park City High School, that you joined, and it seemed like you were kind of hesitant to. It's not a group that anyone asked to be a part of, losing someone. And yet it was so monumental for you. I assume it was started by the wonderful Sam Walsh. Can you talk about that group, how it was dealt with, and then has it continued? Is it still going on?
Yes. Yeah. I weirdly love talking about Grief Group because it was truly just the most powerful thing that I've been able to be a part of. I was invited to join Grief Group probably only a month or two after Sam passed away. After returning to school, Sam Walsh reached out to me and invited me to join Grief Group. And of course, who wants to be a part of a group where you sit around with other high school age kids and talk about your grief? And for me, I was 14. Some of these kids were seniors in high school and they were so cool, and I didn't want them to hear my story. But even within the first session, sat down in the room and was surrounded by 8 to 10 other high schoolers who had experienced loss, some who had experienced loss as early as their first few months of life, some who it was as recent as mine, all parent and sibling loss. And it was just so powerful for us to all be in the room together and have so many unspoken similarities and things that we could bond over. Once a week, a different student would take turns telling their stories. In some cases, it was a 5-minute story. In other cases, it was an hour long story. But the best part is we were all too uncomfortable to make eye contact. So we would sit there and coloring in coloring books with little crayons and colored pencils for an hour. We'd all be sobbing the entire time. But it was just like the one opportunity to truly share your entire story judgment-free. And I honestly have never told my story of losing Sam as deeply and as personally as I did in Grief Group. That may change with the podcast, but it was truly just the most special place. And I'm so grateful I had that opportunity because I know many others don't have a grief group in their school.
And you were talking a moment ago about your legacy, and this is kind of a weird question, I guess, but you were 14. You were a teenager when Sam passed, and teenagers are famous for their worlds revolving around them. What was it like navigating a natural teenage craving for attention and to have things sometimes be about you with your desire to keep Sam's legacy alive?
Yeah, one of the first things someone told me before I returned to school, I had shared that I was really nervous about going back to school and having all eyes on me. And someone had shared with me, like, don't worry, everyone's so self-involved with their own life that they've already forgotten about you. They're not even thinking about you. And that, in a way, was comforting. And in another way, it was like, what do you mean? They already forgot about me? Like, it was a weird thing to hear. I do definitely think I struggled all throughout high school, especially with Sam's loss being so public, of being known as Sam Jackenthal's sister. I really struggled with, like, how do I find my own identity? How am I just Skylar Jackenthal? I'm not tied to Live Like Sam. I'm not tied to Sam Jackenthal. And of course, that's such a huge piece of my life, but I really fought for, you know, carving my own path and making my own name for myself, which is why it was so important for me to eventually get out of Park City and go to school in Boston and start my career in Boston. And really, this podcast is for me like that final kind of way of carving my own path and not becoming just Sam's sister or the girl whose brother died, but like really becoming someone who's hopefully making a name for myself, even though, of course, it's still in the grief space and it still is so heavily tied to being Sam's sister, just in a different way.
Yeah, it's an evolution of that process.
Yeah.
Next, my last question for you is that I'd like to do this for every segment that we have with our resilient youth, is if people were to celebrate or emulate you after you're gone, what would living like Skylar, what would be the thing that you would hope that they would remember and celebrate about you?
Oh, that is a very good question and a complicated one. I'm sure I won't be content with this answer after this.
You can keep revising it over the years.
Yes, if you... I think I'll have to. I think truly just seeing the glass half full, realizing even in the darkest of times, there can still be light at the end. And when it came to launching Live Like Sam, we took deep loss and turned it into love. And that's really been my goal for the rest of my life, is finding a way to make the best out of every situation, see the positive in every situation, because I truly think there is joy and light and happiness in every situation. And life is so much better when you're able to focus on that side of things rather than sadness.
That is well said. I don't think you're going to want to revise that too terribly much.
Thank you.
Skylar, on this show, we talk a lot about mental health, and we do focus quite often on youth. And, we decided this is an important enough topic to do a monthly segment on it, just to make sure that we're not losing focus. One of the things that I hear Mary Beth lamenting all the time is there's so much negativity around, like all these things that are going wrong with our youth today. And that's why we decided to call it Resilient Youth. Youth are rocking it. Can you tell us how youth are rocking it?
Yeah, honestly, I just continue to be so shocked, so impressed by all of the young people I'm surrounded by making a change in the world. Really feels like at every corner, youth are becoming change makers, whether it's they're starting their own podcast, even just being leaders in their team, in the community, volunteering, creating their own businesses, whatever it is. I've had the opportunity to interact with a lot of young people, specifically in our community, who have gone through loss, not only of just a family member, but like we said, loss of their sport, which is like the love of their life due to injury, or just growing older and realizing you can't compete in your sport forever. And it's something that so many people struggle with, but I've just continued to see young people persevere for that, through that, show resilience. And it really is so powerful. And I think that's focusing on what's ahead, focusing on a better future, and knowing that brighter days are always ahead.
That's really great. And what would be your message to the rest of us out there? We parents and adults, what do you want to say to us?
I would say that young people are stronger than you think, and you're probably only seeing a very small percentage of their entire person. The person that they are is so much stronger than that little glimpse that you're seeing. And yes, mental health is real, and especially in the world we're living in now, it's probably unfortunately only going to continue to get worse. But I think to those parents out there, just continue to show your child love and support, and to remember that they are strong. They're going to get through this. They're going to go on to live a beautiful, happy, healthy life. They just need you there to show them love and support, not drag them down.
Will you have guests come on to talk about their stories, and how do you want to hear from them?
Yes, I will be having many guests on to come share their stories with the world. Many of them will be from Park City, as that's where my network is closest, but obviously hoping to expand to youth everywhere. On my Good Grief Instagram, which is goodgrief.pod, you can go in my link tree. There is a Google form where you can submit your application to be a guest on the Good Grief podcast. There's another Google form where you can also submit questions and topics that you want me to cover in the future. So, would love for everyone who's interested to go to goodgrief.pod and share your insights.
Skylar Jackenthal, the co-founder of Live Like Sam and the founder of a new podcast called Good Grief, Life After Loss. And what do you do professionally, Skylar? I got to put this in because you're more than just these two things.
I am a people operations specialist at a startup called Clasp here in Boston. My job is making sure every employee in our company loves what they do. They love coming to work every day. So I have a very fun job, and I love going to work every day.
What a great job. Skylar, thanks so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Skylar.
And Live Like Sam supports KPCW. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Our chemical world is harming our health, from polluted air and unregulated chemicals to processed foods and household products. Extensive research has shown it's wreaking havoc on our immune systems, sparking chronic conditions like diabetes, heart disease, and autoimmune disorders.
Our guest this morning is Dr. Ailey Cohen. She is a board-certified rheumatologist and integrative medicine physician. Dr. Cohen has spent the last 2 decades researching, writing, and treating her patients with this in mind. She joins us today to discuss her new book called Detoxify: The Everyday Toxins Harming Your Immune System and How to Defend Against Them. Dr. Ailey Cohen, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to start here. It's really great to have you, by the way. This is so important. And as a rheumatologist, you see an increasing amount of autoimmune disease. And I've always wanted to talk to a rheumatologist to really get your take on what is going haywire in our world, do you think, that is creating this really sudden rise of autoimmunity?
Yeah, so this is something I've watched over the last, I've been practicing rheumatology for 22 years. And, you know, and then I was layering in other areas of information, you know, other tools for healing, like integrative medicine training that I felt was so necessary in terms of diet, nutrition, air quality, water quality, sleep, lifestyle. And then I really stumbled into environmental health exposure study. And I did that, unfortunately, because my dog became ill, and I write about it in my book and how I was searching for answers. And what I can say to your question is that not only have I been seeing this as a clinician over these many years, seeing a rise, but then really turning into an epidemic rise of of autoimmune and immune conditions, not just auto directed to self, but even like food allergies and, you know, allergy, you know, immune system reactions to a lot of things, including infections. But the literature parallels this feeling that I had, the epidemiologic, the occupational exposure histories, the great studies that exist, plus even our own CDC data from NHANES data has really highlighted the idea that we have had an epidemic rise in immune and autoimmune conditions. So it really came all together for me at this point with all of what I know about environment, and the environment plays a key role in human health, whether that's, you know, again, chemicals through air quality, water quality, food, but also stress and lifestyle and nutritional deficits, which I talk about in the book, is a really key point here. You can take away all the toxic chemicals that I point out and talk about the science, but you have to add in nutrition. And again, that's something we're missing in modern day times as well.
As a rheumatologist, Dr. Cohen, I'm wondering if you could reflect on what you think we might be missing with Western medicine these days, too, as it seems we're good at treating symptoms but not cause.
Yeah. And listen, I never throw my colleagues under the bus. I love physicians. I was trained in a Western institutions that I, you know, I loved, my mentors, all of that. But what medicine is missing and still is missing, and I won't go into sort of my theories behind that, but what we're missing is training. The system doesn't promote training in environmental health topics like air quality, which we know is so critical, air pollution, dementia, all of these things, but also nutrition. So we're missing this big area of prevention, or what you might consider, you know, upstream components. Everyone wants to understand how they got sick, why they got sick. We're naturally drawn to a cause and effect, you know, type of thinking process. What I can say to you is that, you know, we're now searching many patients, as I see them all the time. And even doctors are looking for extra training on this outside of their formal training, that we have to kind of consider other components. And again, I really like people to think about anthropology for a second, because we are missing this perspective on human, modern day human lives. You know, we've had for 4.5 million years, you know, we've evolved with clean water, clean air. We've had nutrition that was from the soil, right out of the soil, picking things off, you know, trees and plants, killing animals on, you know, if you're, you know, killing animals right from, not processed through weeks and months, with even, you know, cleaners that are put on food for prevention of infection, like salmonella. Like, we've had so many layers. Now, that being said, we've also had an extraordinary explosion of synthetic compounds that were really designed in many ways originally in the 1940s and 50s to really cut back a lot of, to increase convenience, maybe reduce natural resources, to bring plastics into the world and pesticides for fighting overseas. So we've had a lot of explosions, but it does not correlate or sit nicely with our evolutionary template. And if you think about just the last 75 years of these chemicals, thousands of them, our body hasn't really had time to adjust or, you know, to manage this load in terms of even pharmaceutical exposures as well. So it's just a disconnect. And I think when we sit back and look at that, I think it's easier for people to understand why this topic is just so important.
Your book opens with that story about your sweet dog, Truxton, I'm sorry, and how his unexpected liver damage was a catalyst for your wanting to know much more about the chemicals we're all exposed to and how they affect us. Well, here in mining country, the term canary in a coal mine is a well-known shorthand for how animals are often earlier to show toxic exposure. What are some of the first signs that we see in animals, not only our pets, but just in the wildlife around us, that are such indicators that stuff is going on?
Yeah. So, you know, when we start to see things like fertility issues and the rise, you know, the increasing rates of fertility, you know, we see a lot in the animal world. Silent Spring is one of the most important books ever written. And, you know, these are the kinds of things we have to think about. And that was back in the 60s. And of course, I'm blanking on the author. You guys,
Rachel Carson.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. It's early for me. But the idea is that we have known a lot about how the environment gets affected long before humans, because we're observing a lot of those things. But we don't always take that into account when it comes to human health. We're no different. And what's so interesting about environmental exposures that I also pull into this book is that everything is cyclical. When we drop Drano down the bathroom shower sink, or, you know, unclog things or have industrial chemicals that make their ways into waterways, this all goes into our wastewater treatment plants that service our drinking water. In fact, 85% of the U.S. water is serviced by wastewater treatment plants. About 15% is wells. And so that being said, when the laws are so old, the 1974 Safe Drinking Water Act doesn't connect. It only manages 91 chemicals at all of these wastewater treatment plants. And we know that sewage and runoff from manufacturing makes its way into those systems, that comes right back out the other side to head to our homes to be drinking water. So I think people have to understand, sort of, again, perspective, that whatever we're doing to the environment will cycle back eventually into our bodies. And unless we put up the right, you know, fail safe, you know, types of things, like, you know, water filters that I discuss much, you know, I do a lot of talk about water almost everywhere I go. I think it's so unrecognized as a contributor to human health conditions, but food quality, water quality. But we have to be thinking about how what our behaviors are really cycle back into our bodies themselves, and that there are many ways that we can stop this and at least reduce, exposures. And that's what the book is about. It's about empowerment. It's about having agency over your body. It's about thinking about all the things we've been marketed to that we need, that we just don't need. Essentially change the destiny of your health and your life, because you are reducing exposures to things we now know have effects on human health. So by reducing those exposures, the connection is that you're going to reduce risk for health issues.
Several years ago, I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease. That's a thyroid condition. And a couple other like weird autoimmune things. Never had any issues my whole life. We do live in a place, it's called Poison Creek, you know, where all these mine tailings and things go through here. Part of it's a super fun site. Even though Park City is an idyllic situation in a lot of ways, we do have a history of toxins. I mentioned it one time at a book club, and like four or five other women were like, oh, I have that too. I have that too. So if we're noticing these trends, what are some of the first things we could do to evaluate what is possibly being caused by toxins?
Yeah. So what I would say is there's many clusters, although formally clusters is sort of a litigation term. But I would say that I'm in New Jersey and we have the largest amount of Superfund sites in the country. Second is California, and third is actually Pennsylvania. And I would argue Utah's up there because it's a lot of it had to do with mining and the history of mining. So I would say one of the biggest things is to think about what goes into your body as the biggest input is water, and trying to filter as much as you can. There's lots of different types. Thinking about what food quality and what you cook your food in. Also, again, a big issue in the book, I talk about nutrition, and iodine is one of the many nutrients that we are deficient in as human beings in modern day times. And iodine sits in the thyroid gland and actually prevents some of these other harmful chemicals that are on food washes, just everyday chemicals even, to connect to the thyroid and actually dislodge or kind of mess with the thyroid gland. And that's how we get a lot of thyroid conditions. So a variety of them. So one of the things I talk about is, look, if you have a multivitamin that has the right amount of iodine, in not too much, not too little, but the right amount, and other things in a multi that our bodies need every day, not just when we're not busy and we're getting into our health, you know, regimen. We need certain nutrition inputs every single day of our lives. And that's why I really emphasize not just clean eating and food and all those mechanisms, of course, but also what are we missing? Even if we had a bowl of something, we still need nutrition, and it may not be from our food system in modern day times where it's lacking. So iodine's very protective. I always ask my patients who are old enough, you know, take this as flattery, what do they hand out at nuclear power plants when there's a spill or a nuclear outage or something of any kind of concern for nuclear exposure? They hand out iodine tablets, and that's specifically because the thyroid gland sits so superficially in the body, and fixing it with just a little bit of iodine, I mean protecting it, is really what we're talking about. Now that's extreme, but I want people to understand that kind of connection of how vulnerable the thyroid gland is and why we have to kind of make it nutritionally sufficient.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Dr. Ailey Cohen. She's a rheumatologist, and she has written a book called Detoxify, The Everyday Toxins Harming Your Immune System and How to Defend Against Them. And Ailey, I'm wondering, I had heard this, tell me if it's lore or not, that because we're consuming less iodized salt, is that a factor or not, that we're not getting iodine?
I talk about it in the book. So, you know, in the 1950s, the U.S. Public Health Services really actually put iodine into our bread. You know, it was actually a public health measure because there was so much what we call goiter, which was a deficiency in iodine. Mm-hmm. And since that time, a lot of people don't eat bread. And then it was added to salt, table salt, like Morton's, which I grew up on. And you would still get a little bit of iodized salt every single, day or whatever with your food. And since that time, as you mentioned, people have really moved towards unprocessed salt, which is great because you have electrolytes and, you know, this is kosher or Celtic or, processed sea salt. And yet that does not have iodine in it. And so we put ourselves into these modern day trends that may help one thing, but actually may serve us against us in another way. And so, again, that's why I always say have this, you know, sort of set of nutrient supplements that are very limited, but high yield in high quality, but serve a purpose of basically being human fertilizer, and that we need this human fertilizer every day. I even say from birth till death, right? It's very dramatic. It doesn't have to be perfect. This is not about perfection, but it has to be something that we think about. And so, yes, with iodine, you know, it's one of those things that we're just not getting because of our new food choices. And that reduces our exposure and our protection, essentially.
Okay. I love the way your book is organized. Three sections, how to assess, what to avoid, and then what to add. And in the section of avoid, since we just started talking about water, those chapters are what's in your water, what's in your food, what's in your personal care products, and then what's really inside your home. Let's go just briefly a little deeper into water, along the lines of what Mary Beth was talking about. Because of our silver mining past, we have some of the most highly filtered water going through out of because we still get water out of our mine tunnels, abandoned mine tunnels. And it's some of the most expensive water because of what they do and how they treat it. And our water department is so proud how they treat and pay attention and monitor and add new, like really cutting edge technology. And I'm just wondering, what should we think about that?
I think that's wonderful. And look, I speak to regulation the same way. I've been doing this work through like four different, you know, administrations, right? And I applaud all of them for any change we make. I applaud all of the regulatory changes. I don't think health should be partisan. I am a big fan of regulation of environmental chemicals, especially in our food and our water and our air, because again, it gets into us. But what I will say is that when we piecemeal out little pieces here and there, it's just too little when it turns in terms of exposures. And so again, reverse osmosis is now accessible. I talk about it all in the book. Any filtration's good. I mean, I try to get people just even to be thinking about the concept and why, and you can always move through what you choose to do for your family, but they're very cost effective now. I think I have one in my office here, $275. And then the plumber was $150 for 1 hour to put it in. And it's under my sink. I don't have to fill it up. There's a lot of countertop ones that I've tried, but they're kind of a pain. And I'm just too busy, too many kids running around. So the idea is that there's a lot of accessible filtration systems. Reverse osmosis, by its very technology, is probably the most aggressive that anyone can get on the consumer market. It's by pore size. So essentially, it's just catching everything, including minerals, because your next question is going to be, well, should we have this water that has no minerals? Well, we don't get nutrition from water. Our water has never been a source of nutrition for human beings. It's really food. And so what I suggest is having a great glass of RO filtered water with a wonderful, nutritious meal. And to me, that's how you get everything you need. But you do have to take the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to filtration, because by pore size, it doesn't know the difference between a mineral or lead or mercury or cadmium 6 or anything that you can think of that's harmful. It won't know the difference because it's simply by size. And in fact, RO filtration was developed by, even my dad was using it back in for dialysis. He's a nephrologist. That's where we got RO water from, the 70s, because we couldn't put this water, unless it was super clean, into dialysis machines because of risk of infection. And now, since that time, we've had bigger compounds that get caught, and no one knew that back then. So there's a lot of interesting history on reverse osmosis, and it's why I really do promote it in terms of the best choice, because it is accessible to most people.
So we hear a lot about PFAS and the different microplastics and different things, and how they're found all over the world in the most remote places that you'd think would be the purest water, the purest air. Is the toothpaste out of the tube? Is there any way to mitigate what we've already been exposed to?
Yeah. And I talk about these patient cases and how people feel when they simply take away a lot of the exposures. In the book, I have a gentleman named Massimo, and these are patients of mine. Not actual patients, obviously, I changed their name. But the idea is that these are people I see quite often. And you're people that are not just managing rheumatoid arthritis with physically swollen joints that you can see and touch and feel. This is also a component of what people feel in terms of draggy or fatigue. And I go through, how do we rule out endocrine problems, and how do we rule out nutritional, like low vitamin D levels can lead to that, or, you know, medications can make you tired, sleep apnea. There's so many things to go through. But when it is, you know, kind of teased out, there's no question that when you remove a lot of these chemicals, not only do you remove them from your body, not, you know, you're actually, and I'm talking about blood levels and urine levels, where great studies are in the book showing that behavioral changes, lifestyle changes, and even product choices absolutely play into what your body is loaded with. And when it's not loaded with these chemicals, it's remarkable how much people feel better on a variety of different mechanisms. And so I even have a symptom survey tracker, so you can actually start the 21-day plan and maybe write some of the things down that are actually affecting you in terms of fatigue, even subjective things that are hard to, you know, quantify. But as you move through a 21-day plan, which is not perfection, it's just a getting going and getting the process started, you will start to possibly see quite often that symptoms do get better. And that's the hope, is that we make a change that matters and that there's a return on investment, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And are we correct in imagining that what they tell us are detoxifying, like sweat, exercise, doing cleanses, even like chelation at the highest level, are those things effective?
Yeah. So it really depends, again, on the patient, especially when you get to chelation. So you're talking about environments where you have heavy metals. There's no question about it that there are foods that actually can help remove and bind certain chemicals. There is activities in terms of nutrition. Just taking in the right nutrition offsets some of the changes that are seen at the epigenetic levels, which is the proteins that sit on our genes. We can modify those genes and the changes on how those genes are expressed simply by changing out our exposures to a variety of chemicals. By nutrition is another way to combat, you know, in cruciferous vegetables and alliums. And so I go through all the science that we now have to show that what we do matters. And it's never too late, in my opinion, because I've seen patients, you know, resolve their inflammation, change their blood pressure levels. You know, it's not perfection because we're humans and we have confounders that affect these things. But generally speaking, we have scientific evidence that animal studies, occupational studies really do show that these specific toxins and some of the changes we make to day-to-day life will absolutely lower those levels. And so, you know, I can only say that doing this a long time, not sharing brands, not promoting any companies. I've never done that. I teach high school and college, and I write academic curriculum for doctors. My skin in the game is to just educate. And so therefore I'm unbiased, and I hope people will get that as well from the book, you know, when they read it.
I love your approach because it's practical. It's like, cut out what you can, and there are going to be choices that we all make that we know. We were talking about highlighting our hair before, and you know, there are going to be some things that we're just going to do if they're really important to us. But can we talk briefly about these massive things that are inside our homes, like couches and carpets and rugs? What's going to be easy to avoid?
Yeah, it took me about 4 years after knowing all that I knew about flame retardant couches, knowing that my couch had flame retardants, to actually swap it out because it's a big ticket item. It costs a couple grand, you know? So I think people need to be thinking about what their financial situation is, what they're willing to swap out. Number one, I would say is the easiest, is just don't buy a lot of junk products. I mean, we bring so many cleaning products as an example. Sink cleaner, door cleaner, window cleaner, surface cleaner, carpet cleaner. You name the number of cleaners that we've been told that we have to have. And I will tell you, by not buying them in the first place, you save money and you do not expose yourself to lots, if not thousands, of chemicals from what we bring in just for simply cleaning products. So once you change out that, and I do it yourself, ingredients, if you want to make like a three ingredient surface cleaner, a cleaner that does a lot of things. Or you can actually, if you're too busy and don't care anymore, like I don't make anything anymore. That was, you know, 10 years ago. I look at my resources that are vetted for people who do this job well. They are looking as toxicologists into these chemical products and saying this is deemed a 1, 2, 3, 4, like EWG.org. They do a wonderful job with the apps Clearia, Healthy Living, Yuka, Think Dirty. These are wonderful resources to purchase products that you do want. And I think that that's really the flexibility here, even with the book, is that I'm not categorizing any one person in reading this. You have lots of choices to be able to reduce those exposures. And I think that's the important thing, is have choice. And it's a process. This is a journey. I was just talking to my husband. He bought a dishwasher cleaner that I knew was toxic. I mean, you know, he didn't know better and he wanted to make the thing work better. So I smelled my plates and they were smelling like chemicals. And since I've done this for a while, I'm actually super sensitive to these things, right? I dumbed down some of my sensibility, or I should say raised my sensibility, because I've been so not exposed on many levels because I've just been working through the process. Even my office doesn't have those cleaners because I bring my own. So the idea is that there's lots of different ways. It's a matter of doing it over time at your own pace, with things that you feel that you can swap out or not. It's not a race. It's just, it's a journey. And I think that even the fourth A, there's three A's that you mentioned. The fourth is allow. Mm-hmm. So it's assess, avoid or swap, add, which is the sweating and the sleep that helps us with removal and nutrition, all that. And then the fourth A is allow. And I think psychologically, having done this work for a while, that we have to meet people where they're at. And allowing them to make choices on their own is so much more effective than to judge, make people regret, make them feel bad about choices, make them think about their child with disability or their breast cancer they experience. That is, there's no place for that in what I do.
Mm. Wow. Well, this is so great. I wish we could talk to you all day. The book is Detoxify, the Everyday Toxins Harming Your Immune System and How to Defend Against Them. Our guest is Dr. Ailey Cohen. Ailey, thank you so much. What great information. And it's just presented in such a way that it makes you feel hopeful, you know,
yeah.
If you just start modifying a few things that we do.
Yeah, the game is it's an empowerment. I've gamified it. I look like I'm not the victim. I feel like I'm the aggressor. I'm trying to figure this out. And the power is in all of our hands. It's just the way you do it, how fast, what you choose, you know, is so critical to take your time and, you know, jump in. This is just a guide to do it in, I think, in an efficient, evidence-based way.
Oh, so great. And you have a podcast, right?
I do. I do. It's called The Smart Human. All of my social media is The Smart Human. Again, Anthropologic. I named it in early on to be, you know, we all bleed red. Let's get this together, guys. So it's all TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and my podcast, The Smart Human. And also thesmarthuman.com. I have courses. If people want to dive into heavy metals, I have a talk. I have a talk on EMF radiation. They're not long, but they're powerful, I hope. And, you know, so a little bit of everything, and I'll be adding to that list of mini courses that people can take.
Dr. Ailey Cohen, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.